This is Mae Warren. It's June 19th, 1996. This is tape two with Jim Purr. All right, lacrosse. Tell me about lacrosse at Washington and Lee, which I know is a high point.
Yeah, it's, W&L has had a, it's had a much longer lacrosse tradition than a lot of people might suspect. And here again, Mame, I'm not going to get the exact year, but I do know that at some point in the late 30s probably, in the 40s, mid-40s, early 40s probably, W&L students, with the help of a couple of faculty members, created a club, a lacrosse club, that began to play, you know, UVA, and these are predominantly kids who were coming down from Baltimore with that kind of high school, that high school lacrosse experience. And they created a club, and basically for a while coached themselves. And had great had some early success. I can't recite chapter and verse all the records and who beat whom when, but I do know that they would compete fairly favorably with some of the other larger schools like the UVA, where a lot of their classmates from high school were going out of Gilman or St. Paul's or wherever. So they're competing in that very small lacrosse fraternity, that very small circle of people who played the game even then. So we got started in the 40s, and in the 50s and 60s, I'm trying to think now when people came. We had a guy named Wilson Fuster for a year or two who was a coach. Gene Corrigan coached at W&L for a year or two, and Gene is now the commissioner of the ACC and is president of the NCAA this year. Gene was athletic director here for a year, just under a year, before he got the UVA job. So Gene was very knowledgeable about soccer and lacrosse. And then Bob McHenry, Bill's brother, was lacrosse coach for a number of years. Then Dick Slaza, S-Z-L-A-S-A is how you spell his last name. Dick Slaza came on the scene. Now, through those 40s and 50s and 60s, W&L had lacrosse teams. And ultra competitive, but we had we had all Americans. Bill Clements was 1950. He was an all American and was most valuable goalkeeper in the country, the top goalkeeper in the country. And we had other fine players during the course of those years. But you can take the rise of the modern lacrosse program in the early 70s through the early part of the 80s, through the decade of the 70s and the early part of the 80s, and you can attribute the first person that you can point to that really created a successful lacrosse environment was Dick Slaza. Dick was a lacrosse coach from the late 60s through 72, through the spring of 72. And it was Dick Slaza who was responsible for recruiting and bringing to W&L Sam Englehart and Skip Lickfus, Skeet Chadwick, in particular, and then some other guys who became very strong supporting players. But those were very important people when you look at the decade of the 70s, because Sam Englehart was all of these guys were very fine high school lacrosse players. As it happens, all three of those guys came from Towson High School. And Dick was able to interest them in W&L, and they came to W&L. Sam came and joined a mediocre team, and then in the early 70s, and I came in the fall of 70. All of this started in the fall of 70, because in my freshman class, ultimate, as it turns out, were to be three first-team All-American players, and all of those players are now in the Lacrosse Hall of Fame. So it was Englehart, then with some of these guys who came in 1970, that the nucleus of the great, and I say that just, you know, in quotes, the great teams, if you want to look at it in the context of Division I competition. It wasn't Division I as we know it today. It was called university versus college level. We were in the university division, or what is known today as the Division I level. For my last 2 years, first 2 years, it was college level, and then we made a jump up in divisions. So those guys came. And then subsequently there were other people who came, Tommy Kigler, Robbie Lindsay, David Warfield, Charlie Brown, every one of Bobby Clements, Bill's son, every one of those people became All-American lacrosse players here. We had seven my senior year. There were seven All-Americans in the 1974 season alone. That ranged all the way from honorable mention to first team. But in the spring of 72, actually it was in early June, I'll never forget, I was home when school was out, and I was at home. It's a Saturday morning. Dick Slaza came to my house, and he sat down with my father for a couple hours outside, and they had become close friends. And Dick had told him that he was leaving Washington and Lee to become head coach at Navy. Now, you spending so much time in Annapolis, you know what that meant for a lacrosse coach. If you were tapped to be the head coach at Navy, you weren't gonna look around. I mean, if you were at W&L and you had a chance to be head coach at Navy, you'd probably be nuts, you know, to pass it up. So Dick left and became the head coach at Navy. And his story ultimately had kind of an unhappy ending there. He didn't fit in, and it didn't work. His marriage broke up, and it ended up not being a good thing for Dick. But anyway, Dick Slaza left, and then W&L had to go out and hire a new lacrosse coach. Well, we had enjoyed a lot of success in those couple of years. We'd gotten in the NCAA tournament, which was a huge step, you know, for W&L. Weren't supposed to be able to compete with anybody, and now we're playing at the top level. And so Jack Emmer is named lacrosse coach.
What's his name?
E-M-M-E-R, Jack Emmer. Jack had gone to Rutgers. He was a wide receiver for Rutgers on their football team and played lacrosse, and again ended up being a third team All-American defenseman at Rutgers. When he came to W&L, he was coaching at Cortland State in upstate New York. He was coaching the lacrosse team there, and in that spring of 72, they had just pulled off a huge upset in the tournament and beaten UVA. And it was a big deal, a real big deal. So Jack came having earned his, you know, he had good credentials at that point. Jack Emmer wasn't a hell of a lot older than we were. I mean, Jack would have been in his mid to late 20s when he came. And here's another very interesting parallel. It parallels our current coach, Jim Stagnita, at least to my way of thinking. But because there's so much alike, I'll have time to talk about that later. But Jack came in '72, And Jack's from Long Island. And he, you know, he talked just like a kid from Long Island. You know, it was really kind of neat. And you had all these guys, you know, these public and private school kids out of Baltimore, and you had a few kids from Manhasset, and you know, some kids from Long Island and other places, and a couple of kids from Pennsylvania, and could hardly translate what this guy was saying. We didn't know what to make of this thing. But he showed people pretty quickly what was going to happen. Practice started in January at that point, and it would just be running for about a month. And Jesus, he worked us harder than anybody could ever imagine. Dick Slaza had worked his teams pretty hard, but Emmer took it to another level. Because Jack was, you know, he didn't come here to mess around. He came here to win, and to win at a big level. So he just absolutely beat us to death, and which is great. I mean, it was the best thing that could have happened to us. And Jack was smart enough to, you know, to not overcoach the team, because he had some really phenomenal talent on that team. And basically, he just basically let the guys go out and play. And those two years, we did not lose a regular season game for 2 years. And we're ranked very high in nationally. In my senior year, we were ranked as high as number two, and we finished ranked third in the nation. Lost in the semifinals to Hopkins by one goal, 10-11. And you know, that and a dime won't get you a cup of coffee today. But if you wanted to look at a point, that was the ultimate high point. You know, no WNL team has ever done better than that. But it's really interesting. We were all in the right place at the right time. WNL's national lacrosse fame, we've always had a tradition of lacrosse at WNL since the 40s. And there are a lot of well-respected people who played lacrosse here. And WNL is a known name in the lacrosse world. But when you look at it in the broad context, that period of the early 70s is really just a very, very narrow window when all the right people were together at the right time. Now, you can say, well, you know, that's the way it's usually supposed to happen. I mean, you can't really have those sorts of dynasties forever unless you're a Hopkins or, you know, or those kinds of programs that have been established long before ours was. But, you know, a lot of people got caught up in that and tend to forget they're not paying attention to what was happening to the game of lacrosse in that period of time.
And what was that?
Well, it was changing dramatically. At that point, when I was playing here, we used to beat Carolina like a drum, and Duke. It was Snoresville, you know, that was no big deal. Virginia was a different story. And other teams like a Cortland State, Washington College was always tough. But some of the teams, the schools that are now big players in the game, weren't then. We'll take the ACC, for example. Virginia and Maryland were the teams then. And after a while, it wasn't long after I graduated, Carolina decided they want to be a player in the game. So they went out and they hired Willie Scroggs, who came down from Hopkins. He was an assistant there. And within a few years, they had bought themselves a national championship team. And I don't say that cynically. They decided that they would give some scholarship help, and you know, and they did whatever, and it didn't take many, you know, it didn't, in a sport like lacrosse, or some of the smaller, less visible sports, not the football and basketball, it just doesn't take that many kids. So over a 3-year period of time, if you gave, let's say, 3 or 4 full scholarships or an amount of money that totaled to about 4 full scholarships, you could dole that out and you could attract kids. And what high school guy in his right mind, you start to see the Chapel Hill campus, they're throwing a few thousand bucks your way, you're a blue chip lacrosse player out of St. Paul's or wherever, you go into a beautiful place like Carolina, it's co-ed, it's warm down there throughout the spring, sure, you know, you take that in a heartbeat and go, especially if you got a guy like Willie Scroggs, who was a good coach and people knew. So Carolina very quickly built themselves a program. So you see what's happening. W&L had hit a point up here in the 70s, and meanwhile, Duke and Carolina and other schools are deciding that they want to become a player in the game. We had hit our head on the ceiling in 72 because we weren't going to be able to give any money to it, and we weren't going to, you know, have that kind of situation forever. So we had probably unwittingly we had hit our head on the ceiling. We weren't going to go any further because the university wasn't going to change its philosophy to become a Division I team. We made that decision as an institution in 1954 after the football cheating scandal, when President Gaines said, "That's it, no subsidized athletics." That was it. So here we were 20 years later, still in a non-subsidized era, but we had competed at the very top level in this sport, which was only then beginning to go to a higher level, you see. So what happened was we had our high water mark just about the point where the game then started to increase in popularity and momentum across the country. And that was it. I mean, Jack had some other good seasons, but by the mid-80s, it was clear that the program wasn't going anywhere, and he went to Army. And they hired Dennis Daly, who's a wonderful guy, and he's a great high school level coach, but he wasn't a college level coach with the expectations that people had on him here. And so then Jim Stagnita was hired, and he has brought W&L back very much into respectability in Division III, which is where we should be, and which is where we're going to stay, I guess.
So the legacy of the cheating scandal goes on.
Well, because it affected, you know, let's just say for the heck of it that there was a cheating scandal. I suspect we would have gotten out of subsidized sports, you know, pretty much shortly thereafter anyway. Just because of the way all of those things were going to go. You know, back in the 50s, it was, you know, it just wasn't like it was today. I mean, that's 40 years ago. And things have, the pressures and the money, all that's changed. We couldn't have competed at that level. What might have happened, though, you see, is if we had remained subsidized, we might have made a decision at some point that we would de-emphasize the football and basketball and some of those major sports, and taken the subsidization maybe at another level, like a lacrosse program. Mm-hmm. And if we had done that, we could still be competing today at Division I. Now I'm going to have to. This is where Mike Walsh would say, "No, we couldn't." Perhaps we couldn't, because now there, if you want to have to compete in Division I, you have to have certain league affiliation, and you know, certain things have to happen with the other sports. But it would be, on paper, it would be possible for us to compete at Division I in a lacrosse and maybe a tennis, but not at the other levels. So but take, for example, Georgetown University. You don't hear a whole lot about a lot of their other sports, but basketball, you know, is the sport, and that's at the highest level of Division I. Mm-hmm. Their football teams, we used to play, But because of NCAA regulations, they had to get out of their out of we no longer play them because they had to get into different conference affiliation in order to maintain this kind of Division I status. So, in essence, it's really is the tail wagging the dog. It's the basketball program at Georgetown that dictates what's going to happen to every other program. Now lacrosse is Division I. Dave Urich came from Hobart to start Georgetown's Division I lacrosse program. He's doing a pretty good job of it. They're in the top 15, but he hasn't gotten Georgetown to the tournament yet. And all that's by way of saying, you look at the teams that are playing Division I lacrosse today. Notre Dame, and that's being coached by Kevin Corrigan, Gene Corrigan's son. Dave Urich at Georgetown. You look at the top 15. Princeton is national champion 2 years in a row. UVA, it's still a relatively small, you know, fraternity of well-known schools, but there are some new players in there now. Mm-hmm. And W&L was in there in the early 70s. And through the mid and late 70s too, because Jack had some pretty good teams then too. But
I'm glad you had your moment of glory.
Yeah, it was really. I mean, nobody who played then will deny that it wasn't just a hell of a lot of fun. I mean, it really was, and it was those teams themselves were legitimate. Those were legitimate Division I teams. We could play with anybody in the country. For a while, and then, you know, then these other programs began to come about, and we weren't going anywhere else, and so it just naturally hit a decline. But it was a hell of a lot of fun.
Thank you. Is there anything else you'd like to talk about? I feel like this is usually about the limit somebody's willing to go is a couple of hours.
No, that's. I mean, there are probably a lot more things we could talk about, and I'd be happy to. But I better get back to the sweatshop.
Definitely. Now that I know things that you know that I didn't know you knew, I'm going to be calling on you definitely when I'm writing when I'm writing captions for sure, because you're going to be real helpful at that. I hope.
Happy to.
Thank you, Jim.
Thank you.
This has really been fun. I've learned a lot.
Well, good.